Welcome to the Fire These Times, a podcast dedicated to the easy task of tackling the 21st century from the periphery. This podcast is ad-free and accessible to everyone thanks to the generous donations of Patreon supporters on patreon.com/firethesetimes. For as little as $5 a month or $50 a year, you can help keep this podcast independent that way. The Fire These Times is named after the James Baldwin book, The Fire Next Time, and the music is by Ibrahim Youssef. Thank you for listening and take care.
Well, if it's okay, we'll start with just some intros on your part. We can start with, Rupa, if you can, and then Lisa, and then we'll take it from there.
Hi, I'm Rupa Mukherjee. I work with a non-profit organization called Hell With Us. I come from India, but currently live in Switzerland in a village just outside Zurich. And my work takes me to about 30 countries where Hell With Us works. So sometimes I'm there in the last 2 or 3 years, more virtually than in person. But we work in 30 countries and I support our programs to understand the impacts of climate change on the work that we do and to integrate adequate measures to prepare for the likely impacts that we will experience in the water sector, agriculture sector. We also work on skills development, so new opportunities arising from green jobs, for example. So I coach and support our country programs in concrete practical actions to take and also advise at the strategic level in the institution. So I'm a member of the management board, which is 6 people who guide the operations of the organization. We are about 1,500 people spread mainly in the country programs, about 150 here. I have a background in biology. And then I studied management. So I wanted to do my PhD in zoology, but conditions in Indian universities were not the most inspiring. So I took a detour into management. And I've been an IPCC lead author for the 5th assessment report and now for the just completed working group 2 report of the 6th assessment together with Lisa, who was our CLA.
Hi, my name is Lisa Schipper. I am a researcher. I work at the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford, and I'm also a visiting researcher at the University of Vienna, where I teach in the geography department. My research is and has been for the last 2 decades really focused on trying to understand the links between adaptation to climate change and development. And in that space, particularly, I'm very interested in what drives vulnerability, social vulnerability. So things like gender, for instance, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about religion and how religious belief influences people's attitudes towards risk, behavior in the face of risk, and other kinds of sort of sociocultural drivers of vulnerability, which typically are really difficult to address and really sort of challenging even to understand and sometimes even taboo to talk about. So those are the kinds of things I'm fascinated by, to really try to understand why is it so difficult to adapt to climate change? What are the sort of really deep, deep causes of vulnerability? So in that frame, I'm sort of asking, like, is it actually possible to have fair and sustainable development in the context of a changing climate? So I'm kind of at the meta level, I'm really interested in these issues of if we can actually achieve climate resilient development for all, for everybody, for instance. I have been editor of the academic journal Climate and Development since it started. I was associate editor, now one of the co-editors in chief. And in that process, I've become really, really interested also in the notion of sort of equity in scholarship and whose voices count and who is able to contribute to building the knowledge base on climate change and development and adaptation. And as Rupert mentioned, I was now the coordinating lead author of the chapter on climate resilient development pathways in the 6th assessment report's working group 2, and also have been involved in IPCC in other reports, in the 5th assessment report, in the special report on extremes. But as coordinating lead author, I've become even more aware of sort of you know, whose knowledge are we drawing on, which views get represented in the science, and then eventually make their way into the policy. And so the kind of the imbalance, the inequity in the kind of knowledge that actually is translated into policy and the gaps that are there. So yeah, that's about me.
Thank you both. Obviously, as you mentioned, we'll primarily be talking about the most recent IPCC report. And Lisa, you mentioned this topic of adaptation, maladaptation, which we'll get into definitely in this conversation. But I guess we can, if that's okay with you, we can start with just general reflections on the latest IPCC report, like your thoughts. What are some key takeaways that people need to talk about? How does it differ maybe, you know, from previous IPCC reports and so on?
So for me, this IPCC report has certain very important thresholds that it has crossed. One, that it really brings together and breaks the silos between adaptation, mitigation, and development. So climate resilient development, our chapter, it's the closing chapter of the report. It has reflected right through every regional section as well as sector. And basically what it says is every decision that you take has a relevance for climate in terms of contributing to reducing greenhouse gases, in terms of contributing to reducing risks of from climate change, and shaping also the kind of options that we have in the future. So what kind of transport solutions are we thinking of? Because every investment decision is also locking us into a certain kind of future, right? Closing options, opening new pathways, etc. So it took us quite some time to to discuss and to find our way, because there is no one single pathway to climate resilient development, right? We have different starting points, different governments, communities have different priorities, mechanisms to discuss and manage the trade-offs between them. And it was fantastic to see the amount of commitment and interest to this integrative way of thinking and working and challenging ourselves across all the chapter teams. And Lisa will talk a bit more probably about the policymakers' response to that. But for me, it was so satisfying to see that these topics become mainstream now. And also the fact that questions of equity, fairness, justice are centrally embedded now in the IPCC report. And this is not because of what we bring as authors. You know, this is not our orientation. It's because the literature has grown. There's much more evidence, because what we do is basically an assessment of literature. So there are people from different thematic areas contributing and engaging with climate science. So we have quite a lot of literature of the kind that Lisa talked about mindsets, religion, how it impacts our decision making. We had a philosopher in the team, we had an economist, and each of us brought our knowledge and also network of coordinating, contributing authors to this assessment.
Yeah, to add, for me, this report, I think that the first and most important thing is that there isn't much time left to do anything before things get really serious. So one of the key messages really is about the urgency. And the urgency is because we now understand so much more about adaptation to climate change, but in particular, the limits of adaptation. So the kind of limits that we can't do anything about, so that's what we call the hard limits, and also these sort of these softer limits. So hard limits, particularly natural systems, like when ecosystems simply won't adapt to any more heat or any more moisture, when it just becomes impossible. And we can't just kind of sweet talk them into changing. You know, there's a certain amount of kind of human intervention in ecosystems, so we can help ecosystems adapt, kind of manage ecosystems. But there's, you know, there's a limit at some point where it's no longer possible for ecosystems to adapt to this rapid change. Similarly with human systems, I mean, the most striking thing in terms of hard is when you actually run out of resources in locations and people no longer can live there. So one of the examples is the freshwater that is limited in small islands, but just because of the nature of the way they are. At some point that water runs out. We all need water to survive. So that means people can no longer live there. It's not, you know, just because the island itself disappears, because other things come first. And softer limits are things that we can address, things like funding, for instance, or also education. Those are things we can address, but obviously there's some sort of institutional kind of maybe political will barriers that are standing in the way, and that need to be addressed. We're chipping away at addressing those. But the report does a good job of outlining the kinds of things that are affecting the soft limits. So there was also a chapter on limits to adaptation in the fifth assessment report. But the difference is now that we have a huge, huge amount more research on adaptation since the fifth assessment report, and a huge amount more analysis of the outcomes of various programs and projects around the world. So they're showing us more knowledge about the limits, but they're also showing us that we're not doing adaptation very well, and that in fact sometimes it's ending up being maladaptive, which means that we're actually, interventions are actually making people more vulnerable to climate change rather than less. So that's a huge sort of difference, but you know, it's important because we also understand that adaptation is limited by global warming levels. So since we're already at 1.1, near 1.2, that means that we have very little space before we hit the kind of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, sort of magic marker. And it means, again, put pressure on, you know, we need to act, we need to figure out what we're doing wrong, we need to fix up our adaptation. We need to get more adaptation out there, but we also need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that's what Rupert was saying, this sort of interconnected nature, it's absolutely clear. But it also means we have to act now.
And one of the things that it says, and I have a quote here, vulnerability to climate change differs substantially among and within regions, driven by patterns of intersecting socioeconomic development, unsustainable ocean and land use, inequity, marginalization, historical and ongoing patterns of inequity such as colonialism and governance, end quote. So can we talk just a bit more, you already mentioned it or at least hinted at it, like the differing ways in which climate change is already impacting people today in an unequal manner?
So yeah, I mean, one thing that is critical is that vulnerability to climate change is not, it's not the result of climate change itself. It's the intersection of all of these pre-existing underlying conditions. For instance, political or religious marginalization of people, or other kinds of factors, gender differences, gender norms within places. These influence the kind of opportunities that people have for and flexibility and networks that they have available when things get difficult. And so if we don't, you know, we have to recognize that those things are extremely different around the world. Intersectionality, the notion that different characteristics intersect, so that being an ethnic minority and a woman puts you in a kind of different category from just being a woman or being an ethnic minority, because it creates these multiple different kinds, it overlays different types of usually barriers that create difficulties, obviously, for when you have to deal with a flood or a drought or something. And I think, well, we've known that there's these big differences. There is a huge new literature that also brings in sort of the historical development patterns, and we're now even able to talk about colonialism as a major driver also of these differences in vulnerability. It's always been there in the background, but it hasn't been the focus of so much literature. And so, as Rupa said, the report is influenced, that what's in the report is influenced by what researchers are working on. That's the process of this. It's not a research project itself. It's an assessment of the existing knowledge. So when we have a huge amount of literature that talks about things like climate justice in relation to vulnerability, or colonialism in relation to vulnerability, then we can also draw on that and kind of create more, we have much more certainty. And so these kinds of things really stand out more now with more certainty than before.
What was striking for me also was the amount of literature that is now available on aspects such as voice and inclusion. and the role it plays in people negotiating through very challenging circumstances. And working in the field, we know this, right? That so the networks that you have, but also the power and the cohesion and the space for articulating needs and demands, which is fundamental when very little else reaches the local level. So there's very little climate finance that is actually percolating down to the local level. And it's actually the local governments who are the ones that are most accountable to local communities, and it becomes fundamentally important whether you're represented, your views are heard, and there is more and more literature on these dimensions. And I think that comes across very strongly as one of the enabling conditions, but also arenas of engagement to be able to adapt effectively to the stresses that communities are facing.
We mentioned this term maladaptation, and presumably all of the existing, the factors that we just mentioned, from structural factors to legacy factors and so on, presumably affect whether a country or a society is able to adapt well or not. Can you sort of, is it okay to expand on that a bit more and maybe even give some examples?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Maladaptation is an important concept because it reflects when adaptation backfires. And like, I think it's not something new in IPCC, but it is something that we have a lot more evidence of now. Like I said, we have a lot more analysis of different adaptation projects, programs, strategies, plans, because there are a huge amount more since the fifth assessment report. And so what we see is that sometimes when adaptation is poorly planned, it ends up being maladaptive. And the problem is maladaptation can not only just make things worse, but can also undermine opportunities for adaptation in the future. So it's sort of like this, as Rupa talked about earlier, this sort of the pathways might be closed up. You're sort of locking yourself into a certain pathway. And you can think of maladaptation broadly in kind of three types of strategies that would lead to maladaptation. So one of the most striking ones is infrastructure. Any kinds of adaptation strategies that involve infrastructure, particularly in protection of coastal areas, is we have many examples of how this ends up being maladaptive. And that's because when you have a coastal area that has a certain kind of provides ecosystem services and provides other kinds of services, it has a certain certain circumstances, you say, well, we need to protect this because we're having either kind of coastal erosion or we're having a lot of storms or other kinds, or even sea level rises coming. By constructing something, you're inevitably going to make a change to the ecosystem. You're going to make a change to the way that the water flows, and you're changing the coast, essentially. The thing is, and I think most people who do those kinds of things acknowledge that and recognize that, but sometimes it changes for the worse. And example from Fiji, where there was a wall built to protect a low-lying coastal settlement that didn't take into account at all the fact that there would also be rain happening and that the rain water needed to drain. So the wall actually just sort of sealed in the settlement. And then it created a new problem. It created floods when it was raining. There was no way for the rainwater to drain. But infrastructure is problematic because it tends to be very costly and also more or less semi-permanent. It's very inflexible. It doesn't, you can't make huge changes there. But then you also have other kinds of maladaptation outcomes. So institutions, where you set up institutions that are there to supposed to help people, but actually end up marginalizing other groups, groups who may not be eligible to participate in certain kinds of strategies. So there, an example where a post-disaster project came in, this was in Colombia, and a post-disaster project came in to try to help people rebuild their houses, but they only gave allowances to those people who owned land. They only gave allowances to people who were registered in the existing kind of system. But that kind of registration, very formal process, very complicated, and many of the poorest people weren't able to kind of manage that registration process, and so they weren't eligible to receive any benefit to rebuild their house. So there you see kind of the poorest people becoming even more marginalized because of the way that that a strategy has been developed. And then we have behavioral model adaptation, where people do things to adjust things. And this can be sort of spontaneous. People decide, okay, there's not enough rainwater. I'm not able to harvest anything any longer. I'm going to go to the city and I'm going to look for employment there. And one example from Ghana showed where people were actually sort of really leaving the location to go to urban areas to get an income. But what happened was that when there was actually good conditions for agriculture, it meant that there weren't enough people available to actually manage. And so they couldn't even farm anything because there weren't enough people around to do the job. So these are the kinds of things that tend to lead to maladaptation. And important is to note that there sometimes it's just bad planning, but many times it's not inclusive or equitable planning. That means the people aren't being considered, these people who are sort of standing outside, the people who are not normally in power, or the people who might even be considered to be on purpose marginalized by governments.
I also find that many a times development actions can also contribute to maladaptation. So not the classical adaptation programs, but also things like introduction of new crops, or in response to a changing rainfall pattern to invest more and more in irrigation, when you know that almost in the near term, the rainfall patterns will continue to evolve. And actually that locks in communities into a production system that will not be viable in their own lifetime. And this happens across the world. And growing up in India, I have lived with situations where building embankments to protect communities from floods was the most important task of the irrigation department and the engineering department, because there are high stakes involved, right? There are big contracts, there are interested parties, and we have evidence of how they lock in communities. Many live within the embankment, so they're living on the riverbank, they farm the riverbank because that's the most fertile part, actually. And for a long time, we've been saying we need to move to living with floods rather than managing and controlling floods. And we repeat the same strategies that haven't worked for the last 100 years now as adaptation to climate change. So building walls and embankments, I see that very much in countries like Bangladesh, for example. And there is a clear interested group that would like a permanent solution like a wall. Because the nature-based solutions, building embankments with earth and with perennial grass, etc., they require labor and for communities to be involved. So an external solution seems easy and attractive, but it has long-term negative consequences. And it's these trade-offs that we must be able to discuss and negotiate with communities, government, contractors, you know, different stakeholders. And it takes time, but it's vitally important.
On the question of time, so we're recording this on March 23rd, 2022, obviously. And as it happens, not too long after the IPCC report, I read this pretty horrifying news article in The Guardian on the heat waves at both of Earth's poles. The subline is that Antarctic areas reached 40 degrees above normal at the same time as North Pole region hits 30 degrees Celsius above usual levels. Which, if anything, obviously reinforces the urgency of the IPCC reports. I'm in this discussion group on climate anxiety and related things, and one of the members, Daniel, asked this question, because obviously I was telling them that I was doing this conversation and if they had any questions to ask. And so he asked, I'm always curious to hear climate scientists' thoughts on the paradox of pace. So that's not space, pace without the S. We need drastic plus urgent actions, but deep, sustained, and especially equitable transformation takes time. How do they navigate this? Was Daniel's question. I was curious if I can hear your thoughts on this.
I mean, I think the issue of there is a bit of an incompatibility with the urgency of how quickly we have to act, and also sort of the fact that we know what we have to do, but it's a huge amount of stuff. I mean, you know, we need to redesign the way we think about development. We need to change our mindsets about sort of what kind of future we can expect and what our future aspirations should be, especially it shouldn't be only the people who are living in places that are the most exposed and the most sensitive to climate change who have to change their understanding of what their future should be. It should be those of us also who are living in these very privileged areas that are not yet so affected by climate change. Because we, of course, contribute a huge amount to the greenhouse gas emissions through the fact that we continue to live our lives the way we do. So I think there is a sort of an incompatibility here. And I think there's another dimension to it that I would add is that it's not entirely clear who's responsible for taking action on everything. And I think that there's a lot of discussion, you know, I think in these climate anxiety contexts of, you know, the role of the individual and the pressure that people feel that they need to take individual action and that you know, we need to live. If we don't take individual action, then we can more or less forget it because maybe we consider the governments are incompetent or too slow, or that the sort of all of the private sector, all these companies that are kind of producing fossil fuels and using fossil fuels don't care because they only care about profits. And I don't think that any of those interpretations are necessarily incorrect, but I think it's important to recognize that all of the different sort of actors and the different levels have to act together. Individual action creates problems like anxiety, but also it, you know, there's only so much you can do if you're trying to change your lifestyle to be low carbon, but you can't afford to live near the city center because it's so expensive, but there's no other option, for instance, for public transport for you to get to your job. So the only option that you have available is to drive by car. I mean, those are not things you can put pressure, you can lobby and so on. But at the same time, you know, the ultimate choice and responsibility lies with the municipality or the government or whoever in your region has to make decisions about those kinds of things. So I think the challenge, I worry that this message of urgency falls a little bit flat precisely because it's not entirely clear who's supposed to act. And even though the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports are, by their definition, for the Intergovernmental Panel, it's the whole bunch of governments who are members of the IPCC, who are the clients, the ones who are requesting these reports each cycle. So ultimately, they're the ones that we've been writing for. But we know that there are many other audiences also who are reading these reports and who are influenced by them. So I think there is something there about sort of who's actually kind of feels like, oh, this is speaking to me. I'm going to go and take action and make a decision now. I think part of the problem is around this question of, you know, urgency, but who takes action first?
I really appreciate your comment, Lisa, about everybody taking responsibility for action and not only the ones who are first impacted by climate change, because there's a lot of discussion also around transformative adaptation that we have to move beyond incremental, and the examples of transformative adaptation are often relocation. And those have dramatic social costs. I mean, I come from a community that has been fragmented and relocated several times over, from colonial times to, you know, the partition of India and then formation of Bangladesh. And the community carries a huge trauma from this. These are not easily done, should not be easily talked about. And the only way to avoid large-scale such trauma, intergenerational, is through everybody taking action in the spheres that they can influence. And I think systemic change is needed, and the arenas of engagement are through our right to elect the kind of government that is committed to taking action, to ensuring where our money is going and what our money is financing. So there are many, many levels. And also, I find we as a society respond much better to shocks rather than trends. So there are key moments like COVID that could have led to a transformation in how we use urban spaces, how we commute, how we work, how we use energy. Now there is a moment with the war on what kind of energy systems, you know, what's the foundation of our energy mix. And as citizens, we have to ensure that these moments are grasped. Because at this moment, we are talking a lot about Europe's energy security, for example. but the attention would be lost in the next few months. I think those are the big systemic changes that are needed. And it's not correct to pass on the responsibility always to the individual. But we can influence those choices.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. I will link up, as in I'll add in the description, this video that's been passing out on Twitter of a number of young climate activists, primarily from Eastern Europe. I think it was a Polish activist, she's 20 years old. I don't remember her name at the moment, but I'll find it and I'll include this, who were talking about this link between this whole energy security and obviously what's happening right now in Ukraine. So I'll link that because they are among those trying to make that link and are calling on this obvious urgency that we need to do something about this. The other thing, this whole question of the individual versus the group versus the government versus the corporation, etc., is obviously a very important one. And I will quickly reference an episode, which is 74, I was looking it up while we were talking, that I did with Giulio Mattioli and Julia Steinberger. On the title is called The Political Economy of Car Dependence, Understanding System of Provision, which is a very academic title. But what it essentially means is looking at why do we have societies built around cars? So like not taking that for granted. And obviously the implication with that is that we don't have to have societies built around cars. We can have societies built around public transportation, walkability, cycling, trains, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is just an example because I grew up in Lebanon and there was no other option other than taking the car wherever you went. So it wouldn't make sense to guilt trip someone into like having to use their car less on a daily basis if this is the only option. There are obviously countries and entire continents at times where the easiest way to travel is by plane. It's obviously a problem. And I can think of American friends who fly everywhere basically within the United States. And that's obviously a problem, but America notoriously has a very bad public rail system and so on, at least one that can be improved. So that definitely is something that is a contributing factor. Here in Switzerland, I don't have to take the flight to go to Zurich, for example. I actually think it's insulting that there is a flight from Geneva to Zurich, but that's my personal opinion. But, you know, I can just take the train, which is about 3 hours long, and same to go to Paris. It's 3 hours long and it's fine. There are issues with affordability and access and all of those things that can definitely be tackled, but the infrastructure is there. The rest is a matter of policy priorities, I guess we can put it that way. Okay, so another thing that I wanted to ask, unless you have comments on this, I don't know.
I would comment on that because I think what you've raised now is really the critical thing, is that we know what's wrong. We know what we need to do, and we just need to do it. And I think that's the frustrating part about all of this, and potentially also, you know, why we feel that the Sixth Assessment Report, in some ways, this is the one where we're saying, hey, we've told you this already. We know these things now. But by the way, we now have a lot more options and actually really kind of blueprints for how you should address these things. And I wouldn't be surprised if the mitigation report, the Working Group 3 report that's going to be published on the 4th of April, will come with similarly, you know, we know all these things and this is what seems to work. Because, you know, that's what we have now. It's a sort of this solution. We have solutions available. And so that means that even though there's this urgency, I mean, because there's this urgency, even though there's some uncertainty around, you know, exactly who should be doing what, it shouldn't really be all that difficult. And the pandemic was a good example to show us that actually when governments want to move quickly and act quickly, they can move very quickly. So, you know, of course, that came at huge equity issues, equity costs. There was a lot of groups that were disproportionately affected by the strategies to protect people from the pandemic. But governments do have the possibility to move quickly.
Yeah, the pandemic is a good example because, unfortunately, it's a very good case study of different, especially at the beginning. I remember at the beginning I was paying obsessive attention to different countries reacting differently. There was very notable differences between, say, Taiwan and South Korea, how they were reacting with how we were reacting here in Switzerland, at least it's what I can speak to the most. Just different measures that in retrospect seem pretty straightforward. And I've read that the reason why they were fast is because they dealt with a previous epidemic not that long ago. But very basic things like mass testing, contact tracing, mask wearing, hand gels, social distancing, etc., which were, in retrospect, pretty straightforward. In other contexts, were taken more politically. Like there were political debates around it, and you know, the rest is history, as we say. And I guess what it's not a very perfect segue, but I wanted, if it's okay, to get a bit more technical because. I do know this is a point of confusion with many people, and including myself, although now I'm a bit better at it, but it can be pretty confusing for people to understand the difference between staying under 1.5 degrees Celsius and staying under 2 degrees Celsius. Because for the on a daily basis, this doesn't seem like a huge difference, but obviously on a global level, it is. What can you tell us about this, and what does the report sort of explain on that?
I think a good example is to take the human body. And, you know, a half degree increase in temperature from whatever, 37, is a fever, right? And you feel pretty sick, even though it's only half a degree. It's on the average higher than what where the equilibrium is. And there was a report commissioned by the IPCC and all the governments after the Paris Agreement to look at exactly this question. What's the difference between 1.5 and 2? So that was the special report on 1.5, which was a fantastic piece of work because all the three working groups, which look at physical sciences, which look at adaptation and mitigation, they worked together and produced this fantastic report in a very short period of time. It was not uniformly welcomed by all governments because it really set the urgency for action. But there's been a lot of work since the report, really making it simple for people to understand the difference between this half a degree warming on things like loss of plant species. So the report says that at 1.5 degree warming, 8% of plants will lose half their habitable area, whereas at 2 degree warming, this becomes 16%. So it's a doubling that happens. Huh? When you look at loss of insect species, we know that from at 1.5 degree, about 6% of species will lose half their habitat, whereas at 2 degrees, it is estimated that 18%. So it's a 3 times increase. But the most striking one is probably on sea ice-free summers in the Arctic, where you would have once in 100 years at 1.5 degree such an episode, whereas at 2 degrees, it's once in every 10 years. So it gets 10 times worse. And of course, this has cascading impacts on various things, you know, on the ecosystem, on the weather, in various parts of the world, etc. The difference is substantial.
There's this concept known as overshoot, which scientists talk about. An overshoot is the idea that we go beyond 1.5 degrees and then we can, because we fail at reducing greenhouse gas emissions now, but that we will eventually reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and that will help us come back down so that the warming reduces back down to 1.5. I think, though, the problem is that, as Rupa's just pointed out, when we pass 1.5, this is the threshold that in some ways it's not entirely arbitrary threshold. It is we don't want any warming, but we're already at nearing 1.2, right? So we're getting close to 1.5, but the difference between now and 1.5 is quite big. And then that just becomes sort of exponential as we go between 1.5 and 2, but consequently we'll lose certain kinds of key systems. So coral reefs, for instance, are ones that we can't get them back once we've actually passed 1.5. And therefore that, because they are the homes of so much marine life, there will be these knock-on effects. And what are the consequences there? What are the consequences potentially for food security, for the entire marine ecosystem? But I also wanted to point out two other things. That first of all, there are places that are already experiencing 1.5. It's actually 1.5, we're talking about kind of the global average, but there are places on the planet that are already at that point and feeling the effects as well. And then the other point I wanted to mention is that the kind of we talk about kind of what the climate system will do after 1.5, but the reality is that humans will possibly react in different ways that we don't know. We don't know exactly how humans will react. We know, like Rupa said, if it gets hot, we know kind of what we see when people experience more and more heat waves, for example, more flooding. So all these extreme events. But there could be something bigger. And I think this is sort of what I worry about is sort of these uncertainties around exactly what that 1.5 will lead to in human systems. Will it lead to something that creates more conflict? Will it lead to something, new pandemics, for example? And, you know, and those could potentially be more fatal than the direct impacts of climate change, heat or, you know, lack of food or so on. So I think it's important to recognize the 1.5 in some ways, it's a target that we've set politically, it's in the Paris Agreement, but at the same time, ideally, it should have been 0 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And 1.5 is, in many ways, it's a compromise because we're already past one, and we need to somehow figure out how, you know, realistically, with the way that we're developing, how can we put a cap on it? I think there's, yeah, it's this politics there, and then there's also this uncertainty. But then we know that there are some things that will become really bad.
Thanks for that. Rupa, you mentioned this example of the body temperature example. I think that's a very good one. And it leads me into the next question, which is this question on climate communication. And how do we convey something that is both, there's this concept of a hyper object, like something that's so big, and at the same time, we sort of know what it is because we're in it, but it's also at times abstract, you know, it's all of these things at the same time. This example of talking about it through body temperature, because this is something that, for example, is a better example than the one that I gave, which is that, well, the temperature outside, I don't necessarily feel a difference if it's between 16 degrees Celsius and 16.5 degrees Celsius, but I would feel it if it is my own body temperature average. And I had the episode that was just before this one, or after this one, I don't remember the timeline of my own episodes, because I scheduled them differently, obviously. I recently had Alyssa Hall, and she's this scientist and science teacher in the US. And we spoke about how difficult it is to talk to her students about climate change. And those are mostly 15, I think 14 to 18 years old, more or less, especially when we see headlines such as, she used this example in an essay, which I can link in the description, and it will be in that episode as well. We have 18 months to enter needed action, right? Like, we have 18 months to do this, we have 15 months to do this, etc., etc., which we sometimes see in news articles. Because they read, we have 18 months, and they think of, well, I'm going to be 16 when this happens, or I'm going to be 18 when this happens. And obviously, this can be very terrifying and paralyzing at times. And at the same time, we do know from the IP, so there is a question of like how media represents IPCC reports and so on, which is an entire question in and of itself, but maybe we can pin this for now. But at the same time, we know from the IPCC reports that there is such a thing as quote-unquote narrowing window of opportunity. And, you know, Lisa, you mentioned this at the beginning as well. Alyssa actually argued, and this is something I agree with, that we need to find ways to help people see that they can take part in pushing for change. And again, with all of the caveat of what we mentioned earlier about the, you know, the individual cannot do everything, a community even cannot do everything, it has to be a combination of all of the above, essentially, all of the different actors at the same time. If anything, to make it easier for the individual to do something if there are fewer obstacles in front of us. Just to kind of bring that point home, the example again of the car, it's a much easier argument to make that we need to reduce car dependency if there is an existing good public transport system, which is very obvious if you think about it this way. And also beyond that, she was arguing that there is a role for such things as cli-fi, which is climate fiction, and solar punk and hope punk and all of those other genres that have been popping up in the past few years that I've been more recently starting to focus on myself, because they open up this possibility of just even imagining something different. Because often we get trapped in debating details that are, how do you say this, like just worse versions of themselves. Like, we're debating, is this detail slightly less bad than this other detail, essentially? Is this policy slightly less bad than this one, rather than, well, what is an actually good policy that has a net good and that has all of these other good things associated with it, and so on? This brings me to a question that was also asked in that climate anxiety group I mentioned by Russia, which is, she asked, as a not climate scientist, so she's a scientist but not a climate scientist, I'd be curious to hear how well they think, so the two of you, scientists and academics in general, are doing at publicly communicating or being active in this area. So, like, I guess this is a question about science communication more generally, and maybe climate communication specifically. How do you think we, quote unquote, people in general, and specifically climate scientists and scientists in general, are doing at this, and what are sort of venues to improve, if we want to put it that way?
This, I think this question about how to communicate what's happening in order to not trigger panic, but trigger kind of inspiration to act, is really huge. I don't think that there is anybody who's really been able to solve this very well. If you look at the debates that happen, for instance, on our favorite bird website, Twitter, there's obviously huge rifts between those who think it's important to communicate that there are lots and lots of options available, that we're going to solve the problem, that we can stay below 1.5, which is not entirely inconsistent with the science. But then there's also those who say it's a lost cause. And these are both groups, the kind of the doomerist perspective. And these groups both actually are often scientists, could very well be climate scientists who are working on the same material. The problem is, I think, that there's so many question marks about, you know, behavior, and humans are so difficult to predict. So, you know, will we actually have a policy space that will allow us to go in the kind of the most low emissions trajectory? Or will we continue in this policy space at putting us on this very high trajectory of emissions? I think it's really hard. And I think what adds to it is the complication that, of course, there are many countries around the world that are not democratic and that don't allow for lobbying and allow for people to protest or make their kind of even have an opportunity to really properly vote for the kinds of things that they think matter. And so, you know, we need to keep that in mind. There are countries where, yes, it's sort of an, you know, transparent-ish democratic systems. People can vote for lots of different options. Then there are countries that are transparent, like democracies, where there aren't many options anyway. So we have to keep that in mind in terms of sort of who's in power and how the sort of normal citizens are able to influence. But I think what strikes me particularly is for some reason, we think that it's not possible to say that, hey, there's lots of options, but by the way, if we don't take them, we're heading in a really bad direction. I mean, I think it should be possible to combine both of these perspectives. But unfortunately, they seem like they're becoming very, very polarized. And that, honestly, is a bit of a ridiculous, you know, it shouldn't even be an issue. Why are we even wasting our energy debating these things, trying to communicate with each other, when actually we need to think more clearly about kind of how realistically can we get action going instead? So I think this is a really critical topic. It's just extremely, extremely difficult to figure it out. And by the way, I just also say, I mean, there are also like questions around cultural differences, right? In terms of, you know, like I said, I worked a lot on religion and thinking about sort of how religious belief influences people's perceptions of risk. So these kinds of social cultural dimensions will influence what people see as kind of, what is their lifespan? Is there an afterlife? What kind of, you know, what's their responsibility? What is our responsibility as individuals on this planet? Do we think sort of about us individuals as this generation? Do we think intergenerationally? And I think those are the kinds of things that, or intergenerationally and intragenerationally, those are the kinds of things that are also part of the picture in terms of, you know, we can't just expect, it's not just that everybody, you know, not enough people care. It's that some people really understand the world very differently and understand sort of the future very differently and don't have the same kind of worries about, you know, the current state of the planet, because maybe they have a very, very strong faith, or they're very fatalistic about sort of what, you know, if I behave well, things will be better in the future. So I think we need to keep those kinds of different worldviews in mind as well.
I've been part of the chapter one in the previous assessment report, AR5, where we had quite some discussions about this window of opportunity, you know, the opportunity space that was also a graphic. And now this is mainstream narrative. And I think there is a positive dimension of that, which needs to be constantly highlighted, that a future that is greener, with more, you know, renewable energy, etc., is actually a very nice future. The air will be clean, health benefits, opportunities for outdoor activities. It's a different kind of recreation, etc. And I think we don't do enough to emphasize that. And I think it is inevitable that there will be an overshoot quite soon, and then we have to come back. So it's this positive vision of the future that I think needs to be communicated to the students, because that was your question, right? And not artificial sense of a closing window. The closing window is really an opportunity window. It's not that things will be disastrously, catastrophically dissolving after 18 months. That, I would think, is irresponsible journalism. That's not what the IPCC reports are saying. There was another thought that I wanted to pick up from what Lisa was sharing. We have this discussion among some friends that in places where you deal with the greatest amount of uncertainty, so rain-fed areas, you know, where you depend on the rainfall, but you don't know when it comes, there's no access to irrigation, those are the places where the religion and spiritual activity evolve from, because you're dealing with so much uncertainty that you must have faith in something larger than yourself, something larger than what you can control. And the biggest religions have evolved from those contexts. It's a thought experiment, and you can, you know, validate it in different contexts that we work in. But I think as we face greater uncertainty, we'll start believing in different schools of thoughts. And it's important to see what of what nature are they, because there is a lot of doomism as well. And that would be quite a different pathway from another, which says we are all interconnected and share responsibility for the future we define for ourselves. Yeah, so we have to see how society evolves. But I think we are key players, and we will determine as human beings the fate of the planet.
Yeah, there is this very nice slogan, I don't know, the sentence that I hear a lot in solar punk circles, that like when everything is doomerism, hope can actually be a radical act. And the reason why that is the case is, as the both of you mentioned this in one way or another, but when we say that the future can be greener, the present can be greener for that matter, but let's say the future can be greener, we're not, there's a lot of focus on the things that we will lose, or the things that we will have to sacrifice, or, you know, all of those things. And a lot of people sort of, and this is in my experience, but I think this is true, a lot of people sort of zone out after this, like, you know, I'm already dealing with a lot in my life, why do I have to sacrifice even more? Especially given the tensions, as we mentioned, between the role of the individual and the role of corporations and the role of, you know, class and government, etc., etc. One thing that I do like is that if we have these different, I call them imaginaries, in the same way as today, you know, Lisa, you mentioned Twitter, it's very easy, it's very common, I would say, to have common frames of references that most people understand. So most people would understand a Lord of the Rings meme, some reference from some popular film, like let's say the Avengers, you know, something very popular, something that becomes globalized in one way or another. And through that, you have certain, I don't know if I would call them values, but definitely memes and tropes and and ways of seeing the world that end up being a bit more normalized than others, or at least easier to think about than others, because we have all of those, because we're like a pattern seeking species and we like to see patterns and everything. And this is one way of facilitating these patterns. And if we have more, and I'm personally excited in seeing this more in the video games world, but if we have more solarpunk type, whatever, genres in literature, in movies, and whatever, it becomes also easier for people to imagine themselves in those situations. Because a lot, so to give a concrete example, which I quite like to give often, a lot, solarpunk is very DIY and gardening, community gardening especially. And if you imagine a situation where this is just a cool thing to do because the hero is doing it, or the heroes are doing it, or just like it's just something that is done as, you know, whatever. In the same way as we have the trope of, you know, the billionaire entrepreneur, which we get from Avengers and stuff like that, and this becomes normalized in culture and so on, but you have this other thing that we can do, which is the one I'm mentioning, it makes it easier, especially for young folks and even older folks, to be honest, to place themselves in those situations. And so this is where I would say, and it helps especially with, we mentioned climate denialism a bit. For the most part, in my experience, it's not hard denialism, which is the most common one. Like, most people don't just deny it outright. Most people seems to at least agree that there is something, there's a problem, and we have something to do with it. But there is this other term, which is soft climate denialism, which is like, we know it's there, but like, what can we do about it? It's too much, it's too big, you know, etc., etc. And this, to me, is actually the bigger problem. And this is where stuff like solarpunk and the other examples that we mentioned can have some role in tackling.
I think the issue of sort of, you know, we have these IPCC reports and they have a huge amount of knowledge in them. They are very, the science is very clear about what we aren't doing well, what we need to do, what we can do, the kinds of changes that are necessary. Perhaps they aren't themselves clear in their writing. It's challenging even for me to process, for instance, the Working Group One report, the summary for policymakers. And I think that, you know, maybe what we need to do is we need to consider how to communicate this better, as you said. You know, how do we create role models or shift pathways or trajectories of aspirations so that it becomes more of a climate resilient development pathway, and we actually are seeking our lives to be in ways that are compatible with high climate resilient development. There is a sort of the role models, the icons, films, literature, and so on also contribute to this, certainly. And I think it's interesting that you talk about this climate fiction, which I think is really exciting. But probably there's a lot of static in the way for people to really get these messages clearly. And I think that I spent a lot of time trying to communicate this report now, and I realize, you know, to all sorts of different audiences, I realize how much actually, first of all, it's exhausting. But second of all, I mean, you know, now I'm finally trying to get back to all my other deadlines and my now 10,000 unread emails. So, you know, this is not something that should just be left to kind of, you know, the extra energy of IPCC authors. This is something that needs to be much more concerted. There needs to be much more of a kind of clear effort to create these communication strategies that actually talk to people about the contents and what we know, partly to avoid this eco anxiety issue, the fact that we actually have a lot of responses available. We have these, we know what we need to do, but also to make sure that to help unpick these various very destructive arguments that you said, it's too late, for instance, we can't do anything, and to make it clear that every single choice we make now will push us either towards or away from climate resilient development. So we actually, you know, on a personal level, but also then on kind of much bigger level, government level, company level, whatever. These choices are all heading us towards a way. It's not too late. That's, I think, the key message. So we need to kind of integrate that somehow and maybe do it more strategically. So obviously we need funding for that in some ways. But I think that's a really critical part of actually getting that, you know, the value of the IPCC reports, moving them from just being these scientific reports to actually being actionable reports.
I just wanted to compliment that and say that for me, it's very important to communicate that the people at the front lines of climate impact are not waiting for action to happen from international community. They're not sitting and, you know, enduring the impacts. Everybody is working, trying to deal with it, trying to adapt, trying to cope. Some are maladapting, etc. But there's a lot of action happening out there. And these are some of the poorest communities in the world. And we can indulge in doomism. We can indulge. It's an indulgence, I feel, an intellectual endeavor. But out there, everybody is dealing with the situation with the best of resources and capacities they have. So it's our responsibility in whatever function we have to be part of that process of positive change and contribute to that process. Yep. So, you know, inaction is not an option. And the most vulnerable are fully engaged in coping with this.
Thanks a lot for that, Rupa. Okay, so what are three books that you would recommend to our listeners and why those three?
Yeah, so we just talked about the importance of fiction in allowing us to kind of think in, imagine different worlds and different futures. And I am a big lover of fiction. I really, really like to read about very kind of surreal things. So I love Japanese author Haruki Murakami and his books because a lot of strange things happen and there are cats always. And he always spends a lot of time cooking and listening to jazz. But so I love in particular Kafka on the Shore, which is a very popular book. But there are, I think I've read everything and everything that's available in English, and I love them all. But I also like to read books that are kind of grounded in some sort of history, but still fiction. And I really like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's books. She's a Nigerian, very powerful author, writes a lot in sort of feminist, from a feminist voice. And her book, Half of a Yellow Sun, had a huge impact on me. But in fact, she's written other fantastic books as well, and I highly recommend them. But then I have to talk about a book that is also one that's influenced me intellectually and from my work perspective. And I absolutely love At Risk. It's called At Risk, Natural Hazards, People's Vulnerability and Disasters. It's sort of a must read for anybody who's interested in the social kind of root causes of vulnerability to natural hazards. This book first came out in 1994. Where Piers Blakey was the first author, but the other authors, Ben Wisner, Terry Cannon, Ian Davis, all have contributed tremendously to shaping our understanding of vulnerability to hazards and are in some ways very much kind of architects of thinking about political ecology bringing the political ecology perspective to thinking about vulnerability and hazards. And really, really important sort of underlying work for a lot of the stuff that we now talk about in terms of climate justice. So those are my three recommendations.
That's a great question. And Lisa, I never knew you love Murakami too and Chimamanda. So so many things that we didn't know, and they're so vitally important, the books that we enjoy. The three that I wanted to talk about were... actually, two are by Amitav Ghosh. The first one is The Great Derangement, and I found it very interesting, the analysis of how nature has been moved out of English literature, I would say, to the arena of science fiction. So it is as if human beings have controlled nature and it doesn't play a role in our fiction, and it's only an element of science fiction. And it's a great book because it's a series of essays actually, and it does a fantastic comparison between the Pope's encyclical about climate change and the Paris Agreement. So I found it very interesting. But following that, he wrote another book called The Gun Island, which brings together two regions that are sinking due to the floods. One is Bangladesh and the other is Venice. And when I first moved to Europe, the first place I went to was Venice. And I was struck by the number of Bangladeshis in Venice. So I could actually speak in my language anywhere I went in Venice. We kept getting lost. And then this book really brought it together, how these two communities have been interconnected over centuries, but also now in living with floods. It was really fascinating. And the last book that I want to talk about is a great one called The Gospel of the Eels. It's by Patrick Swenson, and it talks about the European eel, its life cycle, but also embedding it with the story of a father and a son. And it's a book that one should read slowly because it needs to grow on you. And the message of the book that I carry with me is that the eel might seem like a very insignificant creature. If it were to disappear, it wouldn't matter to anybody. But it's a great indicator of what's happening to our oceans, the warming of the oceans, what's happening to our water bodies. And it is so fundamentally linked to so many cultures. So just this importance of climate change and what it might be doing to species that we think are insignificant, don't interact with them in our daily life, but are very fundamental to so many people and so many cultures and so many ecosystems. So it's a great book and I would highly recommend it.
Thank you both for these recommendations. I'm a fan of Murakami. Shimananda, I haven't read her as much as I would like to, but definitely also a fan. And I've written an essay actually on Amitav Ghosh's first book. No, I don't know if it's his first book, but the first book I read, which is The Great Derangement that you mentioned, Rupa. I haven't read the second one, and I know that he has a recent one, The Nutmeg Something, which is also has been highly recommended to me, which I'll try and check it out at some point. But on that note, thank you both for your time. This was fantastic.
Thank you for inviting us.
Defy These Times is hosted by myself, Joey Ayoub. I am also its producer, researcher, writer, and sound editor. If you want to help turn this project into a full-time job, please head out to patreon.com/firethesetimes to support it. These episodes are part of a bigger project, which includes resources, a newsletter, and eventually YouTube video essays as well. As always, thank you for listening and take care.